three complex dimensional manifolds with a bunch of extra holomorphic data encoding the metric for this condition. So the data is the following: a vibration over CP1 and a symplectic form omega on the fibers, but it's valued in the bundle in O2. Strictly speaking, X needs to satisfy a couple of additional conditions for this to work. So let me write out. So firstly, the vibration X CP1 must admit a section, a holomorphic section, sigma, with normal bundle . So the significance of this will become clear, I think, once we do the construction. But basically, what this is asking is that locally we have coordinates z on CP1 and v1, v2 on the fibers, and it kind of locally looks like what we had before. And secondly, if we want a real Einstein manifold, X must have an anti-holomorphic involution. But I'm not going to spend much time on this, because we discussed this already in the case of flat space. We saw that the twister space, you know, the set of CP1s in twister space was a complexified spacetime. And if I wanted to get a spacetime of a particular signature, like Lorentzian or Euclidean, you had to play some game with this anti-holomorphic involution. And in this more global context, the same thing is true. Yeah.
Is the omega on the fiber supposed to be valued in O of minus 2, or is it O?
I think I might have written it down wrong last time. It's valued in O of 2.
O of 2, positive.
Yeah. OK, so what's the construction? So M, the Einstein manifold, is defined to be as a manifold. It's the set of CP1s in X which deform the section sigma. So the first thing we want to know, this is going to be the same thing as what we had for ordinary twister space. Ordinary, the real manifold was the set of CP1s. So we have to know that this is a four-parameter space. This is because, so the normal bundle is O1 plus O1. So that this means there exist normal vectors N1 N2 on a patch of CP1. The patch, say, where z is not equal to infinity. And saying that they're in O1 means, you know, as usual, when I transfer to the other patch, I pick up an appropriate power of z. And these guys, which vanish as n goes to infinity, sorry, z goes to infinity.
I'm sorry, I'm confused by the notation, by the notion of normal bund- the normal bundle being O1 plus O1.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a direct sum and O1 is picking up a power of one power of z as we change patches,
mm-hmm.
then shouldn't O1 plus O1 be the same thing as O1 itself?
No, O1 plus O1 plus O1, so it's rank 2. So when we change patches, there's a 2x2 matrix. Right, because in principle, I take, you know, a two-component vector here, on the other patch it becomes some other two-component vector here with some powers of z in it. So O1 plus O1 means the matrix, it's like this. Like that, we'll see. When I go to the other patch, it's a diagonal matrix with those weights. So I could have had On plus Om, and that would be a diagonal matrix with different powers of z.
I guess just on that question, I also don't really know what the normal bundle is.
Right, so the normal bundle is, here I have x, and inside it, I have a copy of CP1. I'm going to need the image of my section. And on the CP1, we have, I can look at those vectors tangent to x. And inside there, there's those vectors tangent to CP1. If I draw a picture, that's the CP1. Now I can have vectors along there, and I can have just general vectors. The normal bundle, N, is the quotient. So it's a vector, like just a general three-component vector, where I identify two if they differ by something pointing parallel to my CP1. Now, if I had a metric on x, I could just say the normal bundle is things orthogonal to this CP1. And that's probably more familiar. But we don't have a metric, so I'm not allowed to say that. OK, any other questions? You have a question?
I was going to ask. Sorry.
OK. OK, so we have this assumption that the normal bundle is O1 plus O1, which means I can take two normal vectors, and when I transform to the other patch, I pick up powers of the coordinate on the other patch. So I can take two normal vectors which vanish at infinity. So let's say on the patch z is not equal to infinity, we can take n1, n2 basis on z is not equal to 0, these are bases of normal vectors. We have n1 tilde, n2 tilde, a basis. And the transformation properties is that n1 is z tilde and I tilde. So this is what it means to be an O1 plus O1. Okay, and now we can ask, what are the normal vectors which are regular and have no poles? There's four of them. So this means we can move our CP1 in a 4-parameter family. So the picture here is, I think, kind of intuitive. I'll draw it on this board. This is my CP1. And, oh, sorry, let me just draw it. It's hard to draw things in 3 complex dimensions, so then let me draw something in 3 real dimensions. So this kind of indicates my CP1, and it's living in some space, and if I want to move it, you know, if I want to move my CP1, what I need is a normal vector. Because if I give you a normal vector at every point, that tells me how to displace that point away from my original CP1. Now, why a normal vector? If my vector just pointed along my CP1, then I wouldn't actually be doing a displacement of it. I would just be doing like a kind of a coordinate change on my CP1. And well, of course, if I wanted to remain a holomorphic CP1, these has to be holomorphic normal vectors. And also, they can't have any poles, because if it had a pole, one of these vectors would be going off to infinity, and my CP1 would be shooting off to infinity and wouldn't be a closed region anymore. OK, so the conditions tell us that our 4-manifold is built as the set of CP1s in X. So now I need to tell you how to give this a metric. Yeah?
Go.
Can you explain a case in which this like wouldn't work and we wouldn't have like 4? Because I don't know if I'm seeing it correctly, because like the tangent bundle to X is 6-dimensional.
Yes.
And the tangent bundle to the CP1 is 2-dimensional.
Yes.
So I understand the 4, but I
don't. Oh no, I wouldn't think like that though. I wouldn't think these are 4 complex vectors. So the tangent bundle to X is 3 complex dimensional. The tangent bundle to CP1 is 1 complex dimensional. So that gives me 2 complex vectors. But each vector can have a coefficient in front of it. It can be a function of the coordinate. And
Like the important part is that the vectors have no poles. Or?
Yes. So that tells me why, you know, you might, you know, I have two vectors, but they can be multiplied by z and still not have any poles. So that gives me four vector fields.
Should we think of the NIs locally as like DVI?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely correct, yeah. And like these vanish at infinity in the same way. Yeah.
Why DDVI and not D? Because DDZ would move me along.
Exactly, yeah.
And one more question. So,
mm-hmm.
Can we reinterpret the statement that there's four of them as saying the dimension, the space of vector fields that deforms the CP1 is four-dimensional?
Yes, exactly. The space of holomorphic sections of the normal bundle is four-dimensional. Okay, so now how do we get a metric? So if I have a CP1 inside of X, it's a point P and M, because M is, you know, the set of such CP1s. And the tangent space is equal to holomorphic sections of the normal bundle. So, of course, there's four of them, and I want to build an inner product on this tangent space. So I have this picture. My CP1, say I've called it sigma. The normal bundle is the same thing as the vectors which point along the fibers of this map. So that's good, because if I want to build an inner product in this vector space, you need some extra structure. And it turns out the structure you need is like a way of defining an epsilon tensor for these n1, n2s. And that's the structure we have, because the vectors along the fiber are equipped with a symplectic form, so an epsilon tensor. And that's...
Sorry,
Uh-huh.
I don't understand the statement that the normal bundle is the same thing as vectors along the fiber of x and cp1. So the fibers we're talking about is the copies of cp1, right? Over x?
No, the fibers are, the vector fields pointing along the fiber are like those vectors here, which project to zero along here. So we draw the picture. The picture is like, this is my cp1. And up here is my x, and here is my section. But x also projects down to my cp1. So these vertical vectors in this picture, these are literally the things that just point vertically. So when I view them, CP1 down here, they become zero. And now if I take my section, those vertical vectors are always, they can't point along this section. Well, so that they give a basis for the normal bundle. Is the picture reasonably clear?
I'm trying to formulate a question that captures my confusion. I guess, so sigma is a map from CP, we have a CP1.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my confusion starts from the definition of the correspondence between the Einstein manifold zone and the CP1.
Yes.
So the manifold on, like the Riemannian manifold is supposed to correspond to this family of CP1s.
Yes. I made a small mistake. These CP1s should all be sections. That they must project, if I take my CP1 up here, it must project isomorphically to the CP1 and end there.
These vectors would be like invariant under parallel transport, or the opposite, or that doesn't make sense?
We don't really have a parallel, we haven't chosen the data to give a parallel transport map in this context, so it's something much simpler. It's just, The coordinate in CP1 can be viewed as a function on x. So we're looking at these vector fields along the fiber are, they can be thought of as vector fields with v of z equals 0. That's what it means to go along the fiber. And the vector field is a symmetry. And the symmetry preserves the function z. It only moves you up and down. It doesn't move you along the z direction.
And can you explain again why, we want a metric, and you said that what we want is an epsilon tensor?
Yes.
Why?
Yeah, let me explain that in a second. Let me just firstly mention why we have an epsilon tensor. So we assume that data on x means there's a bundle map. And the normal bundle to sigma, and this is an isomorphism to O of 2. This is the data. We assumed that x had, I erased it. We assumed that x had a symplectic form along the fibers. So this allows us to define epsilon ij and I So this is an anti-symmetric pairing. On N1, N2. So in the original case of flat space, we had the epsilon tensor. We used it all the time. So then the metric is, so the inner product on the 4D-dimensional space is, we call this omega, sorry, instead of epsilon. So you can write it, if you want, as a contour integral. It's that. So these two subspaces are null. These are null planes, and well, you may be worried that I started with an anti-symmetric tensor and built a symmetric tensor, but actually you shouldn't worry because I'm implicitly using the fact that there's another anti-symmetric tensor involving z and 1. Does that make sense? No?
Okay. Because the worry would be that omega 1, 2 would be the same thing as omega 2, 1. But I don't know how that's...
Well, this is the... So I just define it like this. I think there's a more clever formula, what do you think? So if n I of z is a section of the normal bundle, you can look at this. I don't know if this helps. I think you should think of it like this, but if you want to be clever and not think of like choosing a basis, you have by having a derivative here, the derivative makes this an anti-symmetric thing too by integration by parts, and that cancels the anti-symmetry here. But I think just looking at the more explicit expression makes it easier to understand.
Yeah. If we define it like that, oh, actually, it won't work. Sorry. Mm-hmm. My worry was that N1, Z, N1 would be omega 1, 1, but then I was worried that the inner product wouldn't be symmetric, but then because you defined it as minus omega ij.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry. I had a question about the bundle map.
Uh-huh.
And zero is the normal bundle at zero?
No, the normal bundle to my chosen CP1, which I've denoted by sigma.
Okay. And how does the map work between the anti-symmetric tensor?
Right, so we had this bundle map is given, X was a three-dimensional complex manifold with this extra data. It was fibered over CP1, and the fibers were symplectic manifolds. So this uses the symplectic structure on the fibers. So we're using the fact that the tangent bundle along the fibers is the same as the normal bundle to the section, which we kind of sketched here. And that builds the, let me build this inner product. Yeah, now, I have no idea how Penrose came up with this thing. I mean, it's kind of clear from flat space that if you want to build a metric, you just copy the formulas in flat space. On flat space, we needed an epsilon tensor on the d by dvs. So that makes you think, oh, we need an epsilon tensor here too. So the really non-obvious part of all of this, though, is why the hell does this solve the Einstein equations? I have just no idea. I don't know. I've never looked at the proof. And it's like, I feel that the point of this, part of this cold construction, which is like a little disappointing, is that you don't get the solutions of the Einstein equations that you really care about from this. You don't get the Schwarzschild solution or something. But I don't know, that's life. Okay, any other questions before I move on?
I had a question again about the map. So we fix a CP1.
Mm-hmm.
We're thinking of like a family of CP1s. We just choose one.
Yeah.
And then antisymmetric two tensors on that, we're saying are the same thing as tensor fields that pick up a weight of two when they transform from one flash to the other.
CP1? Yeah, I didn't. I've got myself a little confused by this point. You have to think a little bit about why this is the correct weight. And this is the correct weight because n is O1 plus O1. So if I take two, if I take the, you know, an antisymmetric tensor field from n, it'll involve O2 because I take two of them and I get a weight 2. So that's why there's an O2.
This omega is the symplectic two form on the fiber.
Yes.
And it's analogous to the Lebesgue tensor we have in flat space, but this is in curved space.
Why is it analogous to the Lebesgue tensor?
Because it's defining the inner product between two spinners. Like, I would think of...
I mean, it's analog to the epsilon tensor on spinners. Is that what you mean by the Lebesgue tensor?
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought you meant the connection. Okay.
In order to have the metric, won't we need another epsilon tensor with under other tensors?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And it's kind of implicit here. You see, I paired one. I'm implicitly saying if I pair 1 and z, I get 1. If I pair z and 1, I get minus 1. So it's implicit. There's a two-dimensional vector space with basis 1 and z. And I'm using an antisymmetric tensor on that. But you can say that more explicitly. Sections on CP1 of O of 1 as a basis, kind of, right, as 1z. But CP1 has an action of SL2. And This is the fundamental representation. And so has a natural antisymmetric inner product. So if I was to write the same argument slightly more abstractly, the normal bundle is V tensor O1, where V is a symplectic vector space. Of dimension 2. That means sections is V tensor sections of O1. And this whole thing has a symmetric inner product. I'm tensoring them. I just take the tensor product of the antisymmetric one here and the antisymmetric one here, and the two signs cancel, and I get a symmetric tensor. So this is promising because we know that the vector representation of spin 4 also decomposes like this. So that's kind of what's going on here. And I feel this construction is kind of confusing, but also kind of beautiful. So I want to spend a few minutes talking about talking about the role of infinite dimensional symmetry algebras in building solutions of the Einstein equation. So this is something that's important in like celestial orography and the study of scattering amplitudes for gravity. So unfortunately, the terminology is kind of confusing. And not really consistent. You know, if you find two people and ask them what W infinity is, they might give you slightly different answers. But for me, the Lie algebra at W infinity is the Lie algebra of holomorphic Hamiltonian symmetries of C2, that is, i.e., symmetries like H, where H is a holomorphic function. Yes, because we should be careful. This is not always true. Yes, but in this case it is. Yes, because this is not compact. It's not. That statement is not true for a compact symplectic manifold.
So Hamiltonian symmetries means preserving the Poisson bracket, or?
I mean, they're given by a Hamiltonian function.
Oh, I see.
Okay. So, okay, this is a bit silly, but if you have a, you know, a two-dimensional torus, there are symmetries which preserve the symplectic form, but the Hamiltonian function has branch cuts. So they're not really, it's not Hamiltonian. Okay, so I wanna, we can use this elements of this algebra to build X's. Build an X as above by gluing first I take X as two patches U union V. U is a copy of C3 with coordinates V alpha dot Z. V is a also a copy of C3 in coordinates and then given a Hamiltonian H of Z, which is a function from C2 times C star to C holomorphic, we can identify the coordinates by, well, firstly we start off with what we're always doing. Poisson bracket with H and I think I should throw in a 1 over Z. So all I'm doing
can you explain why 8 is that
not? Why which? Why
8 of C is
right, so this, it's a holomorphic function, so if I fix Z, it's a Hamiltonian on this plane, two-dimensional space. So it's a one-parameter family of Hamiltonians. So the picture is the following. Here's one patch, and I have, this is Z. Here's my other patch of Z tilde. And up here, I have a copy of C2. Up here, I have a copy of C2. And when I glue them, Z goes to 1 over Z tilde. But these are identified by a holomorphic transformation which preserves preserving the Poisson bracket. And so this transformation, you know, it just has derivative. This is a function of the V's. It's just the usual Poisson bracket. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have any z derivatives, so it's just a one-parameter family of Hamiltonian transformations. Okay, so I mean, all that's going on is like, how do I build an x? X must have a symplectic structure on the fibers. I could say I take my standard local model, which is C3, and I glue two of them together in a way preserving the symplectic structure. That'll give me a more global x.
The Hamiltonian vector fields are like they generate the D-algebra.
Yes.
And like, if we think of H of C as a group action from Z.
Yes, yes.
So then this is basically, since we know that Z generates conformal algebra on C2, then this is just a group action of that.
Well, okay. There are some subtleties. Which I want to kind of skip over. The subtlety is that this exponential might not really converge. So maybe we put a small parameter there. But yes, this is a group action by some group, but it is much bigger than, you know. For example, inside of here, there are just 2x2 matrices. Those are just ordinary rotations in the Lorentz group. There's also translations. But this thing includes its very huge infinite dimensional group, which includes all of your familiar things. So it's somehow telling you that gravity, which you initially thought only had usual Lorentz group symmetry, actually has this hidden infinite dimensional symmetry.
The reason why it's not just 2x2 matrices that preserve the symplectic form, is it because it's a one parameter family?
No, it's because we can have nonlinear transformations too. So sorry, I kind of want to apologize because I didn't prepare this part as well as I should have, but. Okay, so what's the idea? Gravity, or the self-dual gravity, has hidden symmetry of maps from C star to Hamiltonian vector fields in C2. So people will call this loops into W infinity. So we can write down specific elements which will realize familiar symmetries. So d by dv alpha dot, these are just translations. V alpha dot. These are rotations, but there's also things like 1 over z. I think these are what are called super translations. So like the algebra of things you can write down is like far bigger than what you would have naively thought about. Yeah, that's also. And so on.
That's a rotation?
No. So, sorry. Let me make sure that this, I take the Hamiltonian function for phi alpha dot, phi beta dot, phi gamma dot. This kind of thing looks like v, v, del by dv with some indices. It's not a rotation. So I think the history of this is that in the 1960s, people were studying the asymptotic symmetries of gravity. And these quantities, which are not the ordinary translations and rotations, these are part of BMS, asymptotic symmetry group. So I think in the 60s, when they were studying this, they didn't realize they only saw some of them. And it was only more recently that people realized that there's this enormous algebra where I can take any polynomial in the V's and any power of Z. And the twister presentation makes it kind of manifest. Yeah.
The question is, I don't really see why it's a symmetry of the Einstein manifold. So in this way, we can construct the space X by gluing using H,
yes,
which is an element of the W infinity algebra.
Mm-hmm.
But if I take different H's, I'll construct different X's, which,
yes,
naively might correspond to different spacetimes.
Yes, you know, you're absolutely right. That's So it's not a symmetry in the usual sense. Like, it's not an isometry of the Einstein manifold. So there's a couple of ways of thinking about why I should think of it as a symmetry. So when these guys were thinking about it, they did something clever by thinking about asymptotic space-time and maybe symmetries that preserve the metric up to terms that decay rapidly. I don't really understand it. One way to think, I mean, for me, if we go up to twister space, locally it's a symmetry. It's not globally a symmetry, because if I write down one of these expressions, it will have poles at infinity. So it'll change the vacuum at infinity. So the reason it fails to be a symmetry is because I've produced a new vacuum, which is the new Einstein manifold, and the new Einstein manifold is the Goldstone mode. So I don't know, maybe that's the best way of thinking about it. These are kind of symmetries broken by some vacuum at infinity and twister space.
Can you explain the symmetry?
Right. So a tensor like this, because these V's have a pole at infinity, it will give me some vector field on twister space, which has poles. And now if I try to see, is that a symmetry of the vacuum solution of the Einstein equation, I'll, going to be studying on twister space what happens when I take d bar, apply to that, and the poles will have a contribution. So it's not a symmetry because it produces a new vacuum Einstein manifold. I kind of think about this as on twister space, these new manifolds you get by gluing can be thought of as Goldstone bosons, where I've changed the vacuum at infinity in twister space. I think all of this is made much clearer when we think about how these things are related to scattering amplitudes and to CFTs.
But it is a local symmetry that is broken, or a global symmetry that is broken. That's the part that I'm not understanding.
So in twister space, an expression like this is a perfectly good local symmetry. It just has poles somewhere. So because of the poles tell me it's no longer holomorphic there. So it's broken on the locus of poles.
When we say that it's a local symmetry, but not a global one, I don't even see why it's a local symmetry. Because, I guess local where? Local in twister space or local?
Local on twister space.
So if I change my function h to something else, locally, I'm not doing anything to the construction.
Yes. Like if I do this thing, I suppose I look at this construction and I throw away one of the two patches, then this construction does nothing. Or an alternative way to think about it, if I have a H which extends nicely across one of the patches, then the construction does nothing because all I'm doing is change of coordinates in that patch. Sorry, this is not very clear, but another way to think about it, when we wrote down the gauge transformations for our theory, twister space, they were expressions like this. So these expressions where I ask that it's H is holomorphic, these are the gauge transformations on a patch of twister space. This is probably a Wiedern twister space, which preserve the vacuum zero field configuration. So this is what I probably should have said in the beginning. Because this guy acts by something like e to the h and that's just d bar because it's holomorphic. So if you accept this, what's going on is that on space-time, you can say, what are the diffeomorphisms preserving the flat metric? Those are the isometries, the usual symmetries. Let's ask the analogous question on twister space. If I work on a patch of twister space, what are the diffeomorphisms which preserve the vacuum field configuration? It's this enormous group. So on twister space, we have many more symmetries. If I asked them, if I looked at those diffeomorphisms which extended to all of twister space without any poles, that would reduce you again to the Lorentz group.
time we said that this h changes the complex structure? Because you're modifying the notion of modifying the quotient.
I think I made a poor choice of notation, and I used h for two different things. So kind of call this something like this, f or something like this. So we had this h, which is a 0-1 form. And then bracketing with h changes the complex structure. So these quantities are the gauge transformations that act on these. And the way they act, if I take h equals 0, normally a gauge transformation will bring you some new h. But if f is holomorphic, it doesn't. So if f is holomorphic, it preserves the field configuration h equals 0. So they're the analog on Twister space of isometries.
When going from one pass to the other, we are picking poles. So can we say that in some sense we are lifting our Z to not lie in CP1 but lie in C2?
How lie in C2?
Because I think of going from one batch to the other batch as being the definition of projective spaces.
Like, yes.
So. We are considering in some sense and like infinity Twister because.
You mean the CP1 at infinity?
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily because when we're doing this gluing construction, I didn't ask that what I called H as good behavior at infinity. That would reduce you to a much smaller group.
And it still is a map from C2 cross C star, so is it correct to think of C star as the CP1 we
had? Yeah, C star is this region in the middle of the CP1. And H defines the coordinate path change on that region.
So it might not be well defined for CP1 infinity.
Yes. It's subtle because, yeah, so it's going to be something different in that case because CP3, the four sphere does not solve Einstein's equations. It's curvature. So it doesn't correspond to one of these manifolds we've been discussing. It doesn't fiber over CP1. So this story is, we've been discussing it, doesn't apply exactly to the four sphere just because it's not a Ricci flat manifold.